My name is Byron Swanson. Today we are going to talk about liberation theology. Is it okay with God? And as a preface to that, I wanted to talk about our particular focus this week on liberation theology in Latin America and what's going on there before we ask the question officially, is it okay with God? Remember, when we talk about liberation theology, it's all over the place. There are gay liberation movements, black liberation movements, women's liberation movements. Everywhere that there's oppression, anywhere in the world, there are liberation movements, many of which are very, very similar, maybe even identical to the type of liberation theology that we've been talking about, which is focusing in Latin America. But what I wanted to say now about the particular situation in Latin America is something that will go back to one of these little diagrams that we put on the board the other day. And it looks something like this. Can you see where you are? Okay. What I tried to say is that the unique situation that Latin America, which of course would be Mexico, Central America, South America, finds itself in is that since the Spanish invasion, conquest in the 16th century, the people who are inside this pyramid that I made have been dominated by three forces. And remember, those of you that were here when we talked about it earlier this week, what are those three forces that are fencing in, or holding down, oppressing the people in Central America? One is what?
Church.
Okay, the church. I guess we have that up here on the top, and I hate to put that on the top, but that's the official church, the official Roman Catholic Church now. Which is going to come in, even as it did in California. Are any of you familiar with California and the 21 missions, for instance, that moved from the southern part of the state all the way up, each a day's walk, separate? It was always the priest, and who came with the priest? The military. What's the Spanish word for the conquistadors or whatever it is? Anyway, the church always came with the military. Would establish a mission, and in many cases the military, certainly in California, this is why it's so very controversial, the military would force or coerce people, the Native Americans, to be a part of the church. And the same thing, of course, happened in Latin America. That these were the power people, and they came in and conquered and introduced their religion and maintained and sustained that faith and that culture and that style of life with the military. And who is the other power force, perhaps the most important?
Money.
The money, okay, the oligarchy. If it's easier to say wealthy, you say that. And an example I gave is that in El Salvador, for instance, 14 families, and they're listed in books if you want to read who they are, 14 families literally own almost all of El Salvador. And those families that have the wealth are in cohesion with the church and the military, and it probably really doesn't make much difference at all who the government is, who the rulers are, because they too would be under the sway of these particular forces that we're talking about. Now, inside, fenced in, boxed in, triangled in, are the oppressed people. And the point that I want to make today is that the really, as sort of an introduction before we ask who side God is on, is that the interesting and maybe frustrating situation in Latin America is that all of these people inside now are being attracted in the last couple of decades by two other church movements, not the official church. And by the way, how many of you have been to Mexico or Central America or South America and have seen the churches that are in those countries? Have you had any experience at all? Tell me what they're like. You know, the cathedral in every community or in every major diocese at least, what's it like?
Huge.
Yeah.
Impressive.
Big, impressive, huge, and they're very, since the Spanish came over in the 16th century, they brought their Baroque architecture with them, which was introduced in the late 16th, early 17th century, and Baroque, of course, is this ornate, gold, elaborate sort of...
Fat little angels.
Yeah, right. Where you're just, you don't need to, if you, well, anyway, you know what type of architecture we're talking about. And it's such a contrast, if we can use the theme for that, to have these millions of oppressed, poor, poverty-stricken people and these ornate, gold, elaborate, ornate churches. Excuse the redundancy there. Anyway, that's the church again on the outside, but within here, two other churches are vastly gaining popularity. One of those is Liberation Theology, the Base Christian Communities. And the figures on Base Christian Communities have run something like this. It all started about two decades ago in a little village in Brazil, one little Base Christian community. And just because there are a few people here who weren't here during the week, somebody tell us what a Base Christian community is. What's a Base Christian community?
Group of people that have gotten together, that have recognized their poverty, their oppression, and are getting together, studying to see what the Word of God does really say about justice.
Beautiful.
Related to them, and then they form study groups, and then from their action.
Great. And very quickly, what kind of revelations has the Word of God, the Bible, given them? Same kind of thing that Barb has opened up to us every day this week. God loves the oppressed. God invites the poor people, the blind, the maimed to the banquets. Jesus goes to the hated Levi, the tax collector's house to eat, and associates with the poor, the ugly, the evil, quote-unquote, all of these, the wretched of the earth. Anyway, the Bible is that good news. And anyway, getting back now to those are Base Christian communities. They're normally made up of lay people, just a bunch of us that live together and are friends and... rarely, but sometimes there'll be a priest that will meet with them. They will be made up of anywhere from, let's say, 15, maybe make it 10, but the official statements usually say about 15 to 20 families. But anyway, two decades ago, this started in one little village in Brazil where a Base Christian community was originated, 15 to 20 families. Today, two decades later, there are Base Christian communities in 100,000 villages and communities throughout Latin America. And that's how many communities it's in. When you go into any one given community, there will be many, many, many dozens or many, many scores, perhaps, of Base Christian communities. In Managua, for instance, we went to one, but there were several, many others. In Cuernavaca, we went to one, but there were many others. And each one of those Base Christian communities now is going to be, again, anywhere from 15 to 20 families. So some of you that are good in math can figure it up and tell us how many millions or hundreds of thousands of people we're talking about. But in two decades, it's been an absolute explosion. And that's why our topic the very first day was, is this just a fad or is it a revolution? And I guess because of some of the reaction I got that first day, I can't quite call it a revolution yet. But I'm awfully tempted to, and if you talk to me behind, away from the mic, I probably would say that, yes, it's a revolution, it has to be. Something like this just cannot happen and be growing and living and developing as it has in the last 20 years and not be considered at least a near revolution. There was a hand up and I talked right through it.
Do these Base Christian communities meet in homes or outdoors?
Yes, right. They don't meet in these Baroque churches. In fact, when pastors and when, in some cases, bishops have become sensitive to the poor people and have joined Liberation Theology, then they're not allowed in the church anymore. There's a terrible tension. And somebody asked a question about the Pope's position. Who was that? The Pope has traditionally, all popes, but John Paul II especially now, has traditionally been against liberation theology because the Roman Catholic Church has always been against Marx, and particularly because of the atheism thing. They're against the subversivism because the Roman Catholic Church is a hierarchy where you rule from the top, not from the bottom. They're against the violence. So there's a whole bunch of reasons that the Pope has been very reluctant to be anything but negative about liberation theology, although in the last year or so he has toned down or softened his position somewhat. Okay,
but remember that woman in Managua from the base Christian community that was getting ready for the Pope's visit and then after they had it?
Yeah, go ahead and talk about that.
She was telling about how the women had worked so hard for this Pope's visit in Managua, and they had been just excited, and they had just worked and worked and worked for this. But at the same time that they were doing that, they were meeting in their base Christian communities, and they were deciding that they needed to rise up from the oppression and be able to be, have food for their children and not lose their voice to this infernal warfare. And so they were really excited when the Pope was coming. They were saying, he'll be able to help us, and he'll be able to help us fix these things, and he'll be enthusiastic about what we're doing. And they talked to him, and he had them shut up. And they were so discouraged that they came home and they said, we'll have our communities without the Pope. And then just after that, the Pope took the priest away from them, from their community that had been helping them.
So it's discouraging, but on the other hand, just react to that a little bit. Do you think in the long run that's strengthening the liberation theology in the base Christian communities?
Yes.
Not to have the support of the official church, or is it weakening the base Christian communities?
Any opposition is going to strengthen it.
That's another contrary, right? That the more that the establishment opposes us, and we know we've got a legitimate cause and a legitimate need, the more united we're going to become and more strong we're going to become. It's a beautiful paradox. But anyway, that's the point now. In the last couple of decades, now we've got two churches, the official Roman Catholic Church and what is dominantly Roman Catholic, but I put in Lutheran because of our example in El Salvador, although number-wise, the Lutheran Church in El Salvador is, what, 5 congregations? It's small, but it's so powerful, because the bishop is concerned about the people, and the people know that and support that particular bishop in that church. But anyway, we've got the base Christian communities or liberation theology working in here now among the oppressed, and the churches grow. The base Christian communities, again, are growing like a revolution. From one community, one base Christian community 20 years ago to many of those in 100,000 communities today. It's just absolutely revolutionizing the church. Okay, now, in this to muddy up the waters even more, in this circle or in this triangle, also in the last couple of decades, we've had the enormous growth of, take your pick on who you want to, what you want to call them, fundamentalists, Pentecostals, or evangelicals, although I refuse to put that word down because
charismatic.
Yeah, all right. Well, yeah, charismatic is going to be Pentecostal. Right. But they also like to call themselves evangelicals, but I just won't use that word. So we'll call them the fundamentalists or the Pentecostals.
Why you won't use that word.
Well, because what does evangelical mean? We talked about that yesterday when we talked about Luther. It means what?
Evangelize.
Yeah, but if you break it down into exactly what evangelos stands for, what does it stand for? Anybody remember that? I went through it too fast. That was terrible.
It means the good news?
Yeah, it means good news. It means the good news of God's grace and or of God's love and care for all of his people. And it's just not right for a particular group of people to take that word over and make it mean something that might not always remind us of this gracious activity of God. So anyway, I won't use that word, but they would use that word. Now, fundamentalists, Pentecostals, or evangelicals have also been exploding in Latin America in the last 20 years. And the figures that I gave you the first day were right when I reread my material. Every hour, 400 converts from nothing or from Catholicism, usually, because out of the 481 million people in Latin America, almost all of them are Roman Catholic. But every single hour, in this 1 hour that we meet here this afternoon, there will be 400 new converts from mostly Roman Catholicism to either Pentecostalism or Roman Catholicism. And that's going on and on and on in Guatemala right now, which is in Central America. It's estimated by the year 2000, one half of the population of Guatemala will be Pentecostal or fundamentalist. And this particular group of people is probably growing faster than any others. Now, tell me what you know about fundamentalists and Pentecostals, and tell me why in the world you think that this particular insight or approach to Christianity is also being wildly accepted, gleefully accepted by so many people in Central America.
I think one of the things about the Pentecostal is, don't they have what they call glossolalia, and they feel that that you have to have this experience of speaking with tongues, or you're not really a Christian.
Well, in fact, right, it includes all of the so-called gifts of the Spirit, which include, what are they? Speaking in tongues, what else?
Prophecy,
what else?
Revelations.
Knowledge and wisdom, they usually call it. And another biggie, healing, faith healing. Now, put all that together, and why do you suppose that's something attractive, that particular aspect of Pentecostalism? Why would that be attractive to these oppressed people in Latin America?
Well, I don't know about those phases of it, but Catholics I know who have studied the Bible tend to become very fundamental in their beliefs. I think because the Catholic Church must be farther away from that would be my idea.
In this official church with all of its baroque ornateness, you're not going to get
that human, you know, and appealing, and they can no longer be Catholics.
All right, and what else about the government of the Roman Catholic Church? What do we say about it?
It's government. The army.
It's a hierarchy with the guy on top, and everybody, the people are always at the bottom of the pyramid. Now, say some more. Why do you suppose this is so popular, this particular approach?
It's probably quite possible that in parts of Latin America, good medical care is not available, so they see faith healing. And
Yes. As we talked at one of the days, death rate in Central America or Latin America is just absolutely overwhelming. The water, all water, you can't drink the water anywhere, but the people do, nevertheless, their sewers dump into the water, they wash their clothes in the waters, they drink the same waters. It's just absolutely unbelievable. Little children, the death rate of little children is enormous and heartbreaking. And it's the life cycle goes to 40, 50 years or something. And in villages that we visited in El Salvador, there's no medical care at all. Bless their hearts, the Lutherans under Madardo come around in a van every 2 weeks, but you have to walk about 5 miles to even meet the van where it would be. So if all of a sudden a religion can come along and offer healing, wow. How important and how exciting this is going to be. But what else?
There's hope where there was no hope before, a different hope than the liberation people proclaim. As you indicated before, the liberation theology people proclaim hope for this life. Pentecostal, as you indicated, they preach hope in the hereafter.
Okay.
Suffer today, but when you die.
Yeah. Okay. We'll come back to this. So let's bring that up now. We don't have it here in our tape library, unfortunately. We have one of the Bill Moyers tapes that he did about a year and a half or 2 years ago. A series of three on religion in America or religion someplace, but one of them was on liberation theology in Central America. And that tape began with a scene that you would never forget in your life if you saw it. And if you've seen it, you'll remember. It begins in a garbage dump. And by the way, we better take a few minutes and talk about garbage dumps. So Wes talked about it on Monday of this week, those of you that had breakfast that morning when he gave the little morning devotions. But how many of you have ever visited a garbage dump anywhere? Really? You know, not just to dump your sex. Tell us about it. teacher here. What impressions do you have of what was it in?
Seeing the trickle down system in operation. People living, you know, by scavenging, and it really looks like the human.
Right, okay. Our first day in Mexico City 3 years ago, when we first made our visit to Latin America with the Center for Global Education. The very first day we were there, they took us to one of the dumps in Mexico City. And Mexico City is probably the largest, maybe the largest city in the world now, or something like 20 million people, and unbelievable pollution. Anyway, we went to the dump, and the poverty of the people, the oppression of the people is so severe that this enormous dump, which just stretches for miles, actually was one of the most preferred places for people to live. And there were something like 5,000 people who actually lived right in the dump. And all they would do is simply take scraps of board and cardboard and metal, whatever they could, and just sort of tie them together, try to somehow keep them together so they'd have a roof over their head. But they would live right there, and there were thousands and thousands of people who were on a waiting list hoping that someday they would be eligible to move into the dump. And as you think of the dump now, you've got to think of a stench that is just absolutely overwhelming. We worked on the cleanup or the garbology crew a couple days ago and took the garbage up to the compost heap up there, and for a little while I got that same smell. Where we took the garbage for a whole day of holding and dumped it into one of the bins. But then we took the smell away immediately because we covered it with ashes and then with sawdust and then with some compost, nice beautiful smelling compost, and completed compost dirt. You add straw and so forth, or grass or whatever, and it smells as sweet as it can be now. But these people are living in this constant smell of garbage. And why do you suppose it's such an attractive place for them to live?
It's got food.
They're going to pull food out of it? What else are they going to pull out of it?
Clothes.
Anything that they can. That's right. Cans or something that'll help them make a house that's a little bit more sound. And that's their living, is to try to salvage things from these dumps. And the dumps, because they are so big, you know, if Holden had all these people living in them, we wouldn't have a garbology crew. In fact, everybody was waiting to do it there. Here, of course, nobody is really too interested in doing it. But anyway, because the dumps are so enormous and there are so many people that are adding to the dump every day, that they keep burning the dumps. They're constantly aflame. So that they'll reduce themselves. And so what these people are doing now is scratching through these dumps, burning their hands, living in this constant smell and flies and germs and just unbelievable conditions. You can hardly look, let alone stay there very long. But anyway, that's the dump situation. And please, somebody rescue me. Why in the world am I talking about that?
You're
talking about the dump. Oh, okay. Okay. The Bill Gordon. Okay. Isn't she wonderful? Okay. Bill Moyer's tape now begins with the dump. And think the worst thought you can, and they still aren't strong enough about dumps, you know, enormous dumps. And here are the fundamentalists and the Pentecostals singing in the dump and evangelizing, trying to win converts, which of course they were. And why are they doing it there? Because all these people live in the dumps, because that's one of the best places to live in these oppressed countries. And their message was, if you are converted to the Christian faith, as they see it, again, just as you say, then when you die, you will go to heaven and you'll get your reward. Just an unbelievable message, whereas liberation theology, again, is saying what? They weren't in the dump talking to those people because they're meeting in their communities. So what's the contrast, again? What's our word? Is that the contrary?
Contraries.
Okay, what's the contrary again now between this approach to these people and this approach to these people. Liberation theologians are saying, yes, we want to change life now. We want to liberate you from your political and social oppression. We want to give you a life that's worth living here, in this time, in this place, in this hour. And you work there for by reading Marx and acting politically and acting subversively, violently if necessary, to make a difference right here and now. Okay, so now there are other things we need to see about fundamentalists, why they're so attractive to so many people. But at least that's one of the differences.
Isn't what fundamentalists are saying all the same thing as what the Catholic Church is saying?
In a sense, right. The Catholic Church really isn't saying, this church right here, that's right, really isn't saying much more than that. The church is out there to offer the Mass every day to save the souls. This particular church, because it's one of these power structures on the outside of the triangle, isn't doing much more than that. That's a good comparison.
What is the draw then to fundamentalism if that is the same kind of thing the Catholic Church is saying?
Okay, can you answer your own question? Or can
Pentecostals tending to do it one-on-one.
That's right.
And they're tending to do it with a bottom-up structure.
And because this is true in this country, it's true around the world, there is an enormous shortage of priests. The articles that I've read suggest that if the church had enough priests, this probably wouldn't be happening. But they suggest that there's probably one priest for every 10,000 Roman Catholics in Latin America. Whereas these people are coming into every village by the hordes, and they're ministering one-to-one. It's a hands-on community sort of approach. Sort of almost, you know, it is community, like here, but their message is totally different.
They're also, they do a lot of lively singing, and it's a message of joy instead of the seriousness of the justice issues.
Right.
That's appealing.
For people who, for the most part, are very uneducated, unsophisticated, and this is the type of, and I'm saying this, I am not saying this in a negative way, and this is the type of an emphasis that the Pentecostals or fundamentalists would make too, a very common, down-to-earth sort of an approach that is attractive to these particular people.
Huh? Also, the end of the world is coming. It's right around the corner. This is the end, and so enter heaven now, and you can do it now. It's instant, and you can join us, and here is heaven. And,
that's right.
And you don't have to worry about going to hell.
That's right.
Stay out of this hell.
And if I can just say, they're also going to stress when you have been converted in this particular approach.
Eternal life.
Not only are you going to have eternal life, but something's going to happen to the way you live your life. Politically and all the rest of it, you're going to remain the same. But what are some of the changes that you can anticipate?
Inner peace.
Say it again?
Inner peace.
Well, inner peace, but also they're probably going to quit being alcoholics. They're going to quit being...
They'll be new creatures.
Yeah, they're going to be born again, quote-unquote. They aren't going to be, quote-unquote, womanizers. I guess that's the word we've been using in this country this last year. They aren't going to be doing that anymore. You aren't going to be... the town drunk and all of that stuff, you're going to all of a sudden be a born again, a new sort of person. But notice that all of that, it doesn't put food in the stomach, and that doesn't put a roof over your head or any of that. It's just that morally, you're going to somehow be a changed person. And for a lot of people, that's very attractive. Uh-huh.
It seems as if the traditional Catholic Church would be able to cooperate with the fundamentalists or even the wealthy people, the elites, because mm-hmm. they don't rebel, those people in the fundamentalist church, whereas the people in the liberation theology based communities, they are more, I don't know, contra anything.
Yeah.
So is it easy for them to handle these fundamentalists, or are they kind of...
Is it easy for these people to handle these people, to work together?
Yeah, even for the wealthy people to handle the
fear is that what's going to happen is that this and this group are going to break out into a war that's comparable to what's going on in Northern Ireland today. I'm going to read you one example. That here in the little village of Samui in Guatemala. The residents were forced to flee their homes in 1981 after a member of a fundamentalist sect denounced the village as communist to the local military commandant because the people would not convert from Roman Catholicism to Pentecostalism. The sect's leader, with a bandana covering his face, led the army into the village and pointed out people he claimed to be subversives. 34 villagers were taken away and never seen again. The rest fled into the mountains where they hid for 5.5 years. And we go on and on and on. Here's a letter from the U.S. head of one of the fundamentalist groups writing to the church in Guatemala, to the fundamentalists in Guatemala, the Pentecostals in Guatemala, saying, in his letter, he spoke of doing battle in the heavenlies against the Pope and his priests so that God would arise and scatter Guatemala's enemies and establish her Guatemala upon the true rock, that is Jesus Christ. And there have been actually outbreaks of killings that have taken place between these people and these people and these people. It's a tragic situation that's going on.
But I think she brought up one point that where oftentimes the fundamentalists have such simple answers to things that people can be controlled and they don't rebel.
They seem to be very passive because they find the solution in the inner world and not in what is surrounding them in the external world. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be very easy to convince them of anything.
Some Pentecostals or fundamentalists make the same mistake, though, as the people in the base Christian community. And so there is some movement, I think, in that direction.
Yeah.
If you draw a stereotype, I think that's...
How big of a picture are the charismatic Catholics?
I haven't read anything about charismatic Catholics in Central America or Latin America.
In the United States, they're very strong.
Are you familiar with that, Jerry?
Well, I know in Cuernavaca, after they called him the Pink Bishop or the Red Bishop, I can't remember his name, when he retired, the hierarchy
he would have been
installed a charismatic bishop who immediately was very popular with the churches in the suburbs.
Charismatic, by the way, means exactly what the fundamentalists or the Pentecostals stand for. Those people who are looking for the gifts of the Spirit, which include speaking in tongues, faith healing, gifts of knowledge and power, and so forth. Okay, well, I glanced at my watch, which again, the rule, Catherine makes you all sit in the front row. My rule is that you can't look at your watches. Only I can look at my watch. But anyway, I glanced at it a minute ago, and we're getting close to the time when we have to wrap things up. So, it's time to have all of you become God. You're God now, and you've got millions and millions of people, maybe half the world, who are oppressed. And you've got to decide what really is the best form of Christianity to meet the needs of God's people, most of whom, again, are oppressed in this world in which we live. Liberation theology is one of your options. The standard traditional church is another option. Fundamentalism, Pentecostalism is another option. Since many of you, majority of you, are probably Lutherans, and we talked about that yesterday, that's another option. Where do we go from here? What do we do when we know we have to do something? We just have to, right? About the needs of the people that are right under our, right under our border, right under our noses, just about any place we look, if we really look, they're there. What's the next step? What should God do? Is God a fundamentalist? Is God a liberation theologian? Or what in the world is God in all this?
I think what the people of the liberation theology need is a connection between the basic communities and maybe something that is striving to a next level, so that you can come to more, not more power, that might be wrong, but more power that can spread out. So not only the idea within one village, but also to offer a structural solution. Maybe something like political system, not the right system, but I think an organization within the countries.
Okay, what I hear you saying is that you think God ought to start, if he's going to start with any group, he ought to start with liberation of theologians, right? But that you still need to, he still needs to do some refining, or she still needs to do some refining. Say some more. If I'm
maybe I got the question wrong. I don't know what.
Okay, tell me what the question is. I probably not communicate. I didn't communicate well yesterday. What am I asking? It's an impossible.
Did you ask what we would suggest as a solution?
God, and acknowledging that God cares desperately about what's going on in this world, even as God cared back in these days. The whole Old Testament and New Testament and everything we've been reading this week in Luke says exactly the same kind of stuff. There are oppressed people, hurting people, and we've been reading this week with Barbara. What Jesus is doing in those particular situations. But my question is, 2,000 years later now, if Jesus could somehow come and sit among us again around our circle, what would Jesus say is the right approach? This, 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 Lutheranism, or some other option that you might have?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would think God has got to be on the side of the liberation theology people. But I guess because of the struggle and whatnot down there, it must be a he, because of the she would have already taken place.
Yeah.
she wouldn't have put up with it.
Now, part of this thing is, I don't know if you're finished, and I don't want to interrupt you, right?
No.
Okay. Part of this is, if some of you are uncomfortable with some of these things, you've got to challenge God or Jesus or whoever you're talking to right now about it right now. Do you think Jesus could work with this Marxist stuff? Can Jesus be political? Is Jesus okay being subversive? And all the rest of it. I don't know if we're getting into this existentialism or not. But,
you know what I'm going to say, but yeah. Since you made me God, I'll give you the answer, you know, any answer from God is right, see?
Mm-hmm.
But the way I would look at it, I'm very sympathetic with those people. They certainly need help.
Now, those people are who?
The people that are involved in the base Christian community, the oppressed people. If I was God, I would raise up a good political leader and form an organization under the umbrella of a movement that would work to rectify the oppression. And by forming a organization outside of the church, it would attract other people, but that may not come into my particular church group. And with the support, the moral support, and the motivation and the moral support that they gain justification again from the Bible, they could carry out a very strong political action.
But I think if it's only one person again, you said you would politician, that would be again this kind of hierarchy.
I'm talking about a political organization. Not a king.
Okay, that was what I wanted to say.
Yeah.
Well, when the people of Israel were the oppressed slaves in Egypt, God did call the leader, he called Moses, and of course he used a lot of miracles too to get them out of that situation they were in Egypt, and then they were able to get out of that land, the middle land, which doesn't seem very feasible today in this situation. They're trying to...
why couldn't somebody be called out of the oligarchy? A faithful, sensitive person say, this isn't right, and they would have power and influence on both the church and the rich.
That's part of what I'm getting at. Anybody who can be a leader. because leadership is absolutely vital.
That's a beautiful statement, because that gets us into this existential question. A part of liberation theology says that somehow you've got to be poor, because God is poor. You find God in the poor people, the crippled people, the blind people, the lame, the maimed, whoever they might be. That's where God is, and somehow in our poverty, this is again one of these contraries that's so beautiful in the theme for this year. Somehow it's in this poverty that you find God's love and grace. Somehow it's in our nothingness that we find the something which is God. It's somehow in our powerlessness that we find this power that powerful people don't have. It's like in Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, the first chapter. He says, those of us that are wise in God's sight are really stupid, and those of us who think that some things that God does are really stupid are really wise. And that's what this existential thing is doing. Now, my question is, therefore, if we get powerful leaders or oligarchy, can these people handle it? Is the strength ever up there, or is it always down here?
Go ahead. Remember, it was, look back in the South American history, it was Simon Bolivar who liberated South America from the Spaniards, and it may take someone of his character and his strength to do it. That's one opinion.
So you're supporting?
Yeah,
okay, Jerry.
Well, I think we have to look at the Sandinistas. I think they come the closest, perhaps, to representing what Britta and Al are talking about, and they've caused a great deal of anxiety and to our government, representing that kind of possibility or movement.
Must we look at? Excuse me.
The Sandinistas in Nicaragua.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Seems to me, actually, according to the Bible, the oppressed people are already there.
Are already where?
They are the sort of the chosen people. It's the rest of us that has to. I mean, it's kind of objectionable, but it sounds like the rest of us have to go down to be oppressed people.
Okay. Don't raise your hands. Just start talking.
Yeah, I think God is thinking about sending another Amos, and he's going to send it to the USA.
Now tell everybody who Amos was.
Amos is the one who preached justice and judgment on those who were the oppressors. And I think some.
And he was a nobody. He was a campesino, a farmer from the south,
shepherd from Tocoa.
Okay, go ahead.
And here, we are the oppressors, and we are the rich kid on the hill who thinks he's the only Christian. And God's going to slap us down. It's just a matter of time. I believe that.
I think us rich Christians on the hill have to learn that we're rich because of God's grace. And I think he gave it to us so that we might spread it around a little bit.
But rich Christians also have to recognize that we're very rich because some other folks are very, very poor.
Oh, very, very definitely. Yeah, I mean,
redistribution.
When I first went to Philadelphia and drove through some of the fancy neighborhoods on the main line, shortly after having driven through a lot of the roadhouses, I thought, let's go to these roadhouses. Right? that's where all this poverty came from. You know, by third world standards, that's not poverty, but by suburban standards, it's definitely poverty.
So, two or three points. One is, we're going to have to send another Pope John and another Vatican Council to take care of that Catholic business. We're going to have to send. We're going to have to send another.
That's going to take care of this.
Another John Wesley or somebody into America and the West to transform the church and be a leaven to look after the poor. And in the meantime, we're going to see some shaking of the principalities and powers of this oppressor society. We're going to see some shaking that are going to bring us to our knees.
Before we get away from that, can anybody think of an Amos that's been walking in our country in the last couple of years? challenging us.
Jesse Jackson.
Did you all listen to his speech that he gave at the Democratic Convention? What was it, when he was nominated? Oh, it brought tears to my eyes. It's all the same kind of stuff, right? Now, let's take him, if he's a prototype that we might play with. Does Jesse Jackson have a chance to make this kind of stuff work and to change this oppression to equality and to liberate people from unbelievable political and economic...
You'd have to have backing. You'd have to have a lot of people with him.
Does he have it?
No.
Rich people?
Is he ever going to have it?
No.
Yes, he has it.
He has it?
Here they are. Go on and talk to the people.
We'll keep talking about that. What kind of a chance does Jesse Jackson have? He sensitized some of you, right? Could he ever be elected?
No.
I don't think that's the important point.
It isn't? What can he do?
We might find somebody else elected.
He's running for mayor.
Right. If you use the example, I forget the person, the pre-Marx guy who had a thesis and antithesis, and you keep moving.
Hegel.
Uh-huh. Okay, if you use the Hegel model, he can move us a notch or three notches the right way.
If he gets very strong, we'll assassinate him. We kill the prophets.
Yep.
Yeah. Robert Kennedy.
Yeah.
Another point, when we see the Sandinistas, I can't help but think of what's going on in China. I remember when Chiang Kai-shek was supposed to be the rich person to oppress the people, and many people in the church and liberals and academics thought that Mao Zedong was going to be a very good person for the Chinese. And I think the Islamic Connector backed Mao Zedong. They thought once the communists took over China, it was sort of a there were agrarian reformers, and they were going to bring a better form of life and get rid of some of the poverty in China, and in a way that the people in China would support them forever, and they would be living forever. But now, no one knows what's going to happen in China. But here are people turning against people who, in the past, claimed that they're going to liberate them from oppression. Mm-hmm. In other words, I just wonder how many people in the church who were so strongly in favor of Mao Zedong in the 40s, how they feel now when so many of the Chinese people are now turning against communism. Despite the fact that they've had 40 years of indoctrination and have been given 40 years to make it work. It's a good question. And so when we think of the Sandinistas who follow Marx, I can't help but think is that what's going to happen in Nicaragua over the next 50-year period?
Do you want to respond to that, Jerry, since you brought that up as an example?
Well, I think it's a very good question, a very fair question, but I feel like we have to deal with a whole lot of our responsibility for what we've inflicted on those people and what we've inflicted on Sandinistas as well. I mean, if we go back to the very year in which the revolution succeeded there, even President Carter was sending money to grease the way for the rise of the Contra. In 84, we were mining the harbors. I mean, we imposed an embargo, which is still in place. We keep, we frustrate their plans for the health care. We frustrate their plans for education. And meantime, we're part of what's, I think, generating all of this terrible inflation to their economy.
And low intensity warfare.
Yeah, maybe you've talked about it, but the think group that prepared the platform for the Reagan run at the presidency, name liberation theology is an enemy, and it must be crushed. Mm-hmm. And it seems like yes, there is a lot that's wanting about a Marxist system, and I wouldn't support it as the big show in town. But I do think we have to deal with our own contribution to this.
Yeah, it's time to go, and if you want to go, certainly feel free to do so. But Jerry's just pointed out something that's just awfully scary, and that is, really, do the majority of the people who are here have any chance against these power structures? Now, here we're talking about Central America, but add the United States and our power. Now, we're supporting those people in the church who take this particular stand. We're supporting the military. $1 million a day we pump into El Salvador to keep this military going. We're supporting these people because we want the cheap bananas and the cheap coffee and all the rest that they're giving us by exploiting these people in here. And I guess my question is liberation theology or any sort of liberation ever going to work against these power structures that are there to keep us from doing that very thing?
And then if it does work in the long run, will the people be better off or worse off?
Can there be worse off?
Yeah, question back then.
Well, I was just going to say, I think there are other models you can look at besides what's happening in Nicaragua, Costa Rica, for instance, where, what was the guy's name, Figueres or something like that, 30 years ago or whatever, came in, established democratic institutions, abolished the army, and Costa Rica has certainly not applied the U.S. line, particularly in the last few years. They're an independent country now. Mm-hmm. Certainly there's the system in Costa Rica is far from perfect, but the structure is in place for hope for the future there. I think Venezuela is another example of the same sort of thing. So I think there are different models than the Sandinista, which don't involve this tremendous revolution and violence that accompanies that sort of thing. And I think we have to be very careful in saying, okay, we're going to support, this is the only way out, this tremendous amount of violence that's going to occur, many thousands of people dying, to overcome the suppression. Now that, in itself, I mean, we're condemned by supporting liberation theology, in my mind, with a Marxist bent, we're supporting killing thousands of people.
But we're doing that right now.
We're already doing that, yeah.
We're supporting killing thousands and thousands and thousands of people now.
Yeah, but I think our policy is designed to prevent that sort of revolution from occurring, isn't it?
Where does violence come into the action of the liberation theologists, or is it a non-violent resistance?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because that is important to speak to that. We talked about it earlier in the week. Many liberation theologians would reject violence totally. In fact, we've got examples from our own experience of some of the most loving, forgiving, non-violent reactions among these base Christian communities that we've probably ever seen in our lives. But anyway, for many, violence is a non-possibility. It would strike that. And that's why I put maybe on the board. For those people who do say violence is an option, it's only because they say violence is already being perpetrated on us. And the example I've given several times this week is a woman being raped. Is a raped woman supposed to just lie there or stand there and allow the raper to rape? Or does the raped woman have an opportunity or a right to somehow try to violently push this person out of her life to keep him from violating her? And that model or that example can be used in liberation theology. That's the only time that violence would be used. We already are being raped. Don't we have the right to somehow try to stop this violence and stop this violation of our lives?
I don't disagree with that. I'm just saying, I think there are other models to follow. And
hey, your Costa Rica model is beautiful.
I would much rather go that way, but there are a lot of problems in finding the right people or the right time to do it.
do we eat dinner tonight at 5:15?
5:15, yes.
Okay, so I'm going to officially dismiss you. I've appreciated so much your participation. Unfortunately, there are no easy answers. I guess that's the bottom line. I am still agonizing. I love so much of what I see happening. Nothing's perfect there. I've got problems with many things on that chart, but I've got problems with good old Lutheranism too, as I expressed to you the other day.